As you're turning to Romans 7, I'll tell you about something that happened to me last Sunday. Before we were able to start heading home, my phone got a text, and there was a Christian not from this congregation who said, "I need some help. I want to know if you can aid me." The person is talking with someone, a family member who's dealing with the Seventh-day Adventist Church. The person has become involved with that particular organization, and the Christian said, "I've never had to deal with that. What passages would you use in talking with someone that is a member or wants to get involved with the SDA Church?" I gave her three, and one of the passages that I pointed to was Romans chapter 7. I want to put out what we didn't put out on the board last week. You may remember from Romans chapter 7, and tonight we'll pick up with Romans chapter 7 and verse 4 in just a minute. In Romans chapter 7, verses 1 through 3, Paul said, "I'm talking to people who know about..." Anybody remember the key word? "I know about people who..." All right, "you are people who know about the law." And then, having said that, he introduces some information about the law. He says, "There's this woman..." Just draw a little box there. "And she gets married to a man." We'll just put "man" there to be especially clear. Okay. All good? That's okay. Now, these people who know the law, Paul says, she decides that she's going to go out, and she is going to, just put an addition there, she is going to go out, and she's going to get married to a second man. Paul said, if she does that, what does that equal? All right, it equals adultery. You can't do that. But then he says, in this situation, let's say that that first man dies. If that were the case, and she wants to, let's erase this, he dies, X him out, and now she wants to go out, and now she wants to marry a man, is that okay or not?
Yes.
It is. Now that's not complicated. But Paul says, this is the illustration that I want you to bear in mind when we're talking about the law. He says, here you are, focused on the Jews right now. He says, you were essentially married to whom? Moses. Now, if they wanted to go out and say, well, okay, we're married to Moses, but we're going to go out, let's think about what happened under the Old Testament. We're going to go out, and we're also going to be married to Baal. How's that going to work out? And God does use the word adultery in the Old Testament, right? So you can't have that. His point is, you were married to Moses, but what happened? There was a death. And because of that, what's occurred? All right, you can marry, and you have married another who was who?
Christ.
Now, when I try to tell this sister on the phone, and you can only describe things so well as far as not drawing them out, I'm obviously not the world's best artist anyway. But if you are married to Christ, and you go back and you also try to be married to Moses, guess what? That's like being an adulterer or an adulteress. You just cannot have that kind of relationship. And once she saw that, hopefully, she said, wow, I see that. I can use that. And you can use that as well. When you talk to people who are thinking that we are somehow bound by the Old Testament law today, Romans chapter 7, verses 1 through 3, and then you can throw in verse 4 as well. Very, very helpful. Another passage that we talked about was 2 Corinthians chapter 3, where Paul, from a slightly different perspective, also makes that same contrast. Anything that you want to add or ask before we pick up with Romans 7 and verse 4? Okay. In that fourth verse, Paul says, wherefore, you can see the conclusion, wherefore, my brethren, ye also were made dead to the law through or by the body of Christ, that ye should be joined to another, even to him who was raised from the dead, that we might bring forth fruit unto God. Paul says, you were joined to Moses, you were tied to the Old Testament law, but there has been a death. You have been severed from the Old Testament law by or through the body of Christ. Thinking about our illustration on the board, just as that death would allow a person to be married to another person, assuming that that person is eligible in God's sight to be married, Paul says that you have had a similar kind of experience in the spiritual realm. Now, here's what's really interesting, and this is one of the points that I made in that phone call. When he talks about law,
you have a word which may seem to be kind of a general word. And when we're talking about, with that lady, the Seventh-day Adventist, the Adventists, they divide the Old Testament into two basic parts. They would say that there was Moses' law, and they look at that as the ceremonial law. And then they would say there is this other sense in which law is used, and that is the eternal law. And when they go back to the quote-unquote eternal law, or whichever phraseology they choose to use, they will say that these are the Ten Commandments. Well, nine of those Ten Commandments are not so problematic. I mean, thou shalt not murder, and thou shalt not steal, those kinds of things. Not a big issue, but where the hang-up comes is the Sabbath day. So I told her, I said, let's take a look at Romans 7, and we'll probably cover this again, but just so you can see it maybe twice, take a look at Romans 7:7. When Paul talks about this law that they have been made dead to, notice what he says. What shall we say then? Is the law still sticking with that same idea of sin? God forbid. Howbeit, I had not known sin except through the law, for I had not known what? I had not known coveting except the what said? The law said, and what did the law say? Thou shalt not covet. Well, guess what part of the law that was? Yeah, it was part of the Ten Commandments, right? So if we have died to the law, well, okay, but the law that we have died to included what? Thou shalt not covet, which was one of the Ten Commandments. And that is the law, Paul said, we died to. We're no longer attached to the Ten Commandments. Thus, if you're talking with somebody who comes along and says, well, we just think that we're under the Ten Commandments today. Paul says you died to the law, and then as you skip down a little bit, he explains exactly or precisely what that law was. When you look at how he describes dying to the law, he uses a preposition dia in the original, which means that we died through the death of Christ, we died by the death of Christ, or we died by means of Christ's death. One commentator said this, I'll share the quote with you, Paul could have still put the thing quite simply. He could have said that we were married to the law, that the law was killed by the work of Christ, and that now we are free to be married to God. But quite suddenly, he puts it the other way, and his suddenly changed picture, it's we who died to the law. And that's right. Well, that was a tough thing for some of the people in the first century to accept. When you think about the joining, Paul says, sticking with their illustration again, you have died to this, but you've been joined to Christ. It would make sense to ask how we're joined to Christ, wouldn't it? I mean, this seems like a pretty big change. If you've been made dead to Moses' law by the body of Christ, how are we going to be joined to Jesus Christ? If we back up a chapter in Romans 6, don't we have an answer to that? Romans 6, verses 1 through 4. Paul said, Jesus died, he was buried, he was raised. What happened to you? You died to sin. And you were buried with Christ. How? Baptism. Baptism. You were joined to Christ in that process, and then you've been raised up to walk in the newness of life. Romans 6 and Romans 7, therefore, go together very, very well. Anything that you want to add or ask before we move down a little further? Okay. Sticking with some other things that we have, when we think about being freed from the law of sin, we should have no worries about being connected to the Old Testament. We should have no worries about having to keep some part of the Old Testament or being justified by a law system, that is, by flawless law keeping. We had some visitors Sunday morning, a lady who's come out of the Amish faith, and maybe you met Delbert, I believe was the name of the fellow that she was with. They're hoping to be back with us again on Sunday, so be good to be praying that they'll return and that we can be able to have an opportunity to teach them. And they had some questions. And this is one of the things that came up. They said, what do you believe about the Old Testament? They heard me reference the Old Testament. Do you think that we're under the Old Testament today or not? And there are a lot of people that are trying to figure out the relationship between the Old Testament and the New. And it's still a big thing. It was a big thing in the first century as well. The marriage illustration that we have in Romans 7, anybody remember where else Paul talked about that in his writings? Maybe the book of Ephesians? Anybody remember what chapter? Ephesians chapter 5, you could skip over to Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 23. Paul compares Christ to the groom in a marriage. He, of course, is the head of the church, and the church is his bride. When we are baptized into Christ, Galatians 3:27, we are essentially joined to Christ, and it's similar to a husband being joined to his wife. Picking up with that analogy and sticking with it just a little bit, if we come back to our board,
We think about Christ being the head. And he's joined to his bride, the church. If that's the analogy, Ephesians 5, what's that tell us? What are some lessons that we can draw from that? When you think about marriage, what comes to mind? Husband, wife. Some things that you do, or don't do.
So, if I may, you know, I think we all understand when marriage is used to describe the relationship between Christ and the church, it's obviously in a figurative sense, but it's used because it's something we can identify with. And the primary intent in almost every case where it's used is to define this exclusive relationship that
exists.
You know, we go back to the word adultery, and really all that means is the addition of something that ought not be there. And so we can talk about certain things being unadulterated, and we're not talking about a marriage relationship, we're talking about a substance, but the idea still holds. And so when we discuss that relationship with Christ in terms of marriage, what we're saying is anything that comes in might interfere with that, whether that's holding on to the old law, as we see in Romans 7, or adopting the world's practices or introducing our own teachings, anything that alters the nature of that relationship that we're not authorized to add to it is an adulteration, is adultery in that sense.
That's exactly right. Moral impurity, doctrinal impurity from the standpoint of worship, going out and being involved with other groups that are not part of that church that Christ established. For a lot of people, those are foreign concepts. They would say, well, God's so loving and caring, he doesn't mind. Well, yes, he does. And if you can understand the marriage relationship, that should click for you. But for a lot of people, it doesn't. And if they can have that brought to their attention and ponder that for a little bit, that should be very, very clear. So when we think about people, going back to the couple, again, I said if you want to think about what we're like, a lot of people will advertise themselves as non-denominational. We're not. When I became a new Christian, I thought of ourselves and described ourselves as non-denominational. I had a teacher who said we are anti-denominational. And boy, I mean, the first time I heard that, I thought, wow, that sounds radical. But it's not. When you think about the person who is anti-smoking, I mean, it's not that they're just jumping up and down and saying, you know, we hate smokers. It is, we're opposed. We do not think that that is good. We would not say that that is right activity. Now, people sometimes change their mind about that. I happen to catch, and believe it or not, if I had not seen it, I would not have believed it. But I saw the other day about a minute of the Beverly Hillbillies. And sure enough, at the end, there was, I think it was Winston Cigarettes. Winston Cigarettes were pictured on the Beverly Hillbillies. And then in that last minute, it appeared about twice. Well, people have kind of changed their mind over that. And sometimes with the church, people have kind of changed their mind as far as what God allows and what he doesn't. But with God, that doesn't shift. Society can shift back and forth and say, well, this is right, this is good. And then 10 years later or 50 years later say, this is right and this is good. But God says, this is that exclusive relationship. And you just do not bring anything into it that I have not authorized. Anything else that you want to add or ask before we move down a little bit further? All right, if this is true,
we have been brought into this exclusive relationship with God. You think God has a will for us? Yeah. And do we get some insight as far as what that will is in Romans 7?
Look at the end of verse 4. We've been joined to another, well, the one who was raised from the dead, that was Christ, so that what? We might bring forth fruit unto God. What do you think that bringing forth the fruit is? All right, I would think that would be part of it, teaching his word. What else? Bringing forth fruit. All right. Really, it would be trying to fulfill God's word in and will in all ways, whether you're teaching, whether you're helping the people who need assistance, maybe the sick, maybe there are going to be some benevolent cases, you're going to find some people who need encouragement. Putting your hand to the plow, so to speak, and doing what we can. The Bible talks about being busy as far as good works, zealous of good works, is how Paul described it in Titus chapter 2 and verse 14, and that's what we should want to do. Now, God does not want people to keep any part of the Old Testament, because remember from Matthew chapter 5 and verse 17, Jesus said, I didn't come to destroy the law, I came to do what? I came to fulfill it. I came to give the full meaning, the full sense. I came to do everything that was required under the Old Testament, and I came to give you a New Testament system. Then, of course, as we think about this law, Paul begins to identify it, as we talked about in verse 6, it was the law that included coveting. Well, when we think about being joined to another, Matthew chapter 26 and verse 28 comes to mind. Jesus talked about the blood of the covenant. He was going to give that new covenant, which was talked about in Jeremiah chapter 31 and verse 31. And if we try to go back and be part of that Old Testament system, we find that we are actually preaching another gospel. It's not enough to say, well, God had that will for a period of people for a period of time. That was true. That is no longer the case. All right, one more call before we move down to Romans 7, 5, and 6. Anything that you want to add or ask? Okay, picking up then, he says, for when we were in the flesh, the sinful passions which were through the law wrought in our members to bring forth fruit unto death. But now we have been discharged from the law, having died to that wherein we were held, so that we serve in newness of the spirit and not in the oldness of letter. Here is the first occurrence of flesh in this book. I recently said in the class, this was not my observation, but I saw somebody make this note not too long ago as far as a preacher. He said when he sees flesh, he mentally inserts the word self. Now, that may not work for every single passage in the Bible, but when you see flesh, if you sort of think self, it will fit in a lot of different places, perhaps in the majority of places, maybe even in every place. I've not tried to go through and actually do that in every possible text. We've already seen, though, as you back up a little bit, this concept introduced. Let's run some references here. Let's just go back into Romans 5 and Romans 6. Who wants to read for me three references in Romans 5, and then we'll even run you into Romans 6. We'll ask you to get all four of them. Romans, all right, Brian, let's go back to Romans 5 and verse 6.
When we were still without strength, in due time, Christ died for the ungodly.
All right, here it is. When we were without strength, we were in the flesh. We were on the road to self and all that involved. And then Romans chapter 5 and verse 8.
God demonstrates his own love toward us, and that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us.
All right, we were sinners in the flesh. And verse 10.
For if when we were enemies we were reconciled to God through the death of his Son, much more, having been reconciled, we shall be saved by his life.
All right. Here again, you can see the weakness and the sinfulness of that state. And then in the next chapter, if you would please, Romans chapter 6 and verse 20.
For when you were slaves of sin, you were free in regard to righteousness.
Okay, this is the way of life which is completely opposed to God. Every person who has not become a Christian but accountable for their sins is in this state. A little bit later in Romans chapter 8 and verse 6, I'll read that verse as well as verse 8. Paul said, for the mind of the flesh is death, but the mind of the spirit is life and peace. And then down there in verse 8, he said, they that are in the flesh, he says, they cannot please God. This is the way of life which is going to result in eternal destruction. As Paul talks to people, and again, perhaps he has in mind here the Jews thinking about their life, he says that you allowed those sinful passions to reign. If you have the King James translation, it is worded in a slightly different way. Anybody have it?
The motions of sin.
Yeah, that seems kind of strange as far as a description, the motions of sin. So some other versions might be helpful, but it's the idea of you're allowing sin to guide your lives. Do we find some examples today? Just probably don't have to scan the news too much to find some examples where sin guides the lives of people. Yeah. I mean, you think about that. You're trafficking. I mean, it's not a sin through ignorance, but that is willful ungodliness. You traffic in people, whether they're young or not, underage or not. Where else? Sin guides people. Sin leads people, rules people. Right?
Astrology.
All right. There's another one. You look to the stars to get insight about life, how to live. Anything else? Sin guides people. What about just animalistic behavior? People get angry and, I mean, they erupt. We've seen people climb through drive-through windows. I mean, I never thought in my lifetime I would see that kind of behavior. But can you imagine McDonald's? Burger King, KFC, you're so upset. I mean, we probably can't imagine that. Hopefully we can't. But you're so upset, you get out of your car and you climb through the window and try to shake down the clerk somehow. Come on. What are you thinking?
You're not.
That's true. You're not. George?
Yeah, I'd like to circle back around the definition of flesh as we see it used. Based on the examples you just gave, because I think they illustrate very clearly a very limited perspective. When we talk about the flesh, we're talking about something that exists in the physical universe. And the defining characteristic of the physical universe is that anything that possesses mass is subject to the effects of time.
Correct.
So our perspective is necessarily limited by these bodies we inhabit and the passage of time as it affects them. We don't easily see beyond it, and yet we understand that we are eternal beings kind of driving around these vehicles of flesh and bone, if you will, for a time, until it's time to get rid of them and move on into the rest of eternity. It's one of the reasons I think why Christ used parables so much. He took these eternal concepts that we can't really wrap our heads around fully, and he gave us physical examples that were close enough to work with so that we could understand them, so they would fit within our perspective. And so when we talk about works of the flesh, what we're talking about are the works of people who do not admit to the existence of the eternal soul, whose perspective is strictly limited to the here and now, to that which is subject to the effects of time. They can't see beyond. They can't see the possibility of something transcendent. And their decisions then are informed by that limited perspective.
Yeah, and that's where you have some high-profile atheists that have picked up a PhD and beyond. They get into debate with a creationist, and the creationist presses them. When you go back and you look at what Nazi Germany did, the millions of people that were murdered, was it wrong? Well, yes, it was. Tell me why. Everybody knows it's wrong. No, that's not a basis for it. If you're willing to affirm that it was wrong, what was the basis for it? What law was broken? And they will hedge and dodge and weave and twist and turn and do all kinds of things, but you get down to that point where if you are limited to the here and now, it just doesn't work. At some point, the belief system that you have collapses. Anybody?
Yeah, we can discuss morals, the mores of a society, what it views as right and wrong. But yes, if you want to get into the discussion of ethics, that only happens when there is something transcendent, some transcendent authority figure.
Yeah. Anybody else? Okay, let's talk about what we have here. Let you take a stab at this. He talks about these sinful passions. Well, we know what those are. Plenty of examples of that. He says, which were through the law wrought in our members. Let's pause right there. He says these passions were through the law. What's he mean? Well, let's think about it for a little bit. What did the law do? God gives this law, and there are a lot of thou shalt nots in there, right? God says, thou shalt not worship this false god. Do you think some people had not heard about that false god when that law was given?
Yeah.
Yeah. So when I say, Steve, don't go worship Baal. Well, Steve's never heard Baal before.
You've given him some ideas.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we'll talk about whether or not that was a good thing for God to do in just a little bit. But now I have enlightened Steve a little bit. It's almost like Adam and Eve, isn't it? They'd probably seen the fruit. But when God says, thou shalt not eat, if they had seen the fruit, now all of a sudden it's what? Oh, yeah. The child, the young child, going around and don't touch that. Well, maybe the child would have at some point, but now you've called attention to that. Do we find that that's still a problem today with people? When the law calls attention to something, it's kind of a reverse consequence. We don't want to have a problem over here, so we call attention to it, but that actually amplifies the issue. Steve?
Forbidden fruit was kind of?
Yes.
That's one way of looking at it.
Yes.
We didn't really want that until not Adam. How really wanted.
Yeah. Well, we've seen that with guns, right? I mean, everybody and their brother seems like they bought a gun. They say, guns are going to disappear. Oh, I never wanted a gun before now, but if they're going to disappear, what? Toilet paper is disappearing. Well, we already got a case in the closet, but if it's going to disappear, then I better do what? I better get three. And then all of a sudden, the stuff just starts flying off the shelves. So sin works in that same kind of way. And that's what Paul says. He says these sinful passions, they were made known through the law. And that actually, shall we say, increased sin. It called people's attention to it, and they began to do even some things beyond what they normally would have done. He says, through our members, of course, as we look at the book of Romans, that word members, it can describe using our body in a way which is righteous, a way which pleases God, or we can use our body in a way which does not please God, and that, of course, is the wrong way to live. When people did what the law condemned, there was a consequence, of course. Paul said that consequence was going to be death. And if you turn back to Romans 6 and verse 23, we are reminded that that consequence was going to be spiritual death. Paul says that sin comes with a wage, and that is the wage of death. James talked about James 1:14-15, Peter, 2 Peter, yeah, James 1:14-15, that the fruit of disobedience brings death. What else do I want to tell you? The word discharged is rendered delivered in the King James translation. That's the same word that's used back in verse 2 to describe the woman who is loosed from her husband. The ASV uses the word discharged in both places. Brown said here, this word means God's putting out of action through the cross the destructive powers which threaten man's spiritual well-being. Well, since Paul has talked about being released from the law, anybody who says, as we mentioned a few minutes ago, that wants to bind some part of that is guilty of false teaching. Paul says that we are no longer held under the power of the law. Some other things that we're going to see here as far as we get down a little further into the text. In Romans 7 and verse 11, he's going to tell us that the law reveals the deceitfulness of sin. That's going to pick up with what we were talking about a minute ago. He's going to tell us also in 10 and 11 that the law reveals the effects of sin and the law reveals the sinfulness of sin. When you start looking at the Old Testament law, it had some basic purposes. Paul's going to tell us in this chapter that the law was holy, it was righteous, and it was good. But at the same time, the law was not the ideal system for man. It was just like some other things. You're building this building, and you've got scaffolding up. The scaffolding is not ideal. But because of how things are progressing, you have to have the scaffolding to complete the project. And that's really what you have with the Old Testament system. It was part of that scaffolding that God had in effect. And that scaffolding, it revealed sin. We've seen that in Romans 5:20. We've seen that in Romans 7, especially as you look at 7:7-13. The law condemned the sinner. The law made man feel like, I'm low, I'm sinful, I'm guilty, I need something to release me from sin. And it certainly was effective in that. And the law was also used to bring people to Christ. Paul will talk about that a little bit more when we get down to the final verses in this chapter. You're going to see the other structural marker here that we've seen before. Paul says, what shall we say then? Again, that's going to try to kind of pinpoint a specific section in the book of Romans. When you start looking at Paul, you see the word say there. You should see the verb say in your translation. And that is, as you look at the original word, a word which goes beyond saying I have something to say to trying to emphasize something. This was really, really important. He wants us to know that the law was not wicked. Let's go back there and look at Romans 7, 5, and 6 again. He says, for we were in the flesh, the sinful passions which were through the law, wrought in our members to bring forth fruit unto death. But now we've been discharged from the law, having died to that wherein we were held, so that we serve a newness of spirit, not in the oldness of letter. We have a completely new way of life. As Paul's going to get down a little further, he's going to use himself as an illustration. Not everybody sees Romans 7 in this way, but my understanding of it is that instead of describing somebody else, Paul's going to say, look, I was a Jew, I lived under the law, and here's how I felt. I felt trapped, I felt guilty, I felt like there was no hope, I felt like I was condemned, and then one day, who shows up? Jesus. And it's like this big weight. Now, I don't, from one perspective, see that in Paul's life. When you start looking at Paul from the Philippian letter, he says, I was a what of the what? Remember, as far as his Jewish life, I was a Pharisee of the Pharisees. And he goes back and talks about his training, presents himself as someone who was really the elite of the elite. And from that perspective, he was. I mean, he was really trying to do what was right. Paul was not a bad man. But as you think about people, even the best people in life, their spiritual status before God is what? Romans 3. All are guilty of sin. There is none righteous, no, not one. Paul was smart enough to realize that he had that problem of sin, so he uses himself as an illustration and once again shows just how wonderful it was that he could be freed from sin. He specifically acknowledges that he struggled with the sin of covetousness. Now, I don't know what he coveted. Maybe he coveted somebody's wife. Maybe he coveted money. Maybe he coveted somebody's property. It could have been a number of different things. But I find it interesting that as he opens up, if you will, about his life, he says there was something, at least one thing, that he coveted. And for him, thankfully, he used that illustration because, as I mentioned earlier and showed you on the board, that tells us that he had in mind the Old Testament law, which certainly included the Ten Commandments. When you look at that word covet, it's, I'm sorry, I want to use the word lust. That's, I think, in verse 7. ASV has that in the footnote. The King James has lust, I believe, once in the text. You have that word, epithumo. It's used as a noun. It's used as a verb in the New Testament, and it describes the sin which rules man. That's a pretty good description for sin, especially with some of the things that we see in our society right now. Another source defining it said this is the desire that flagrantly contradicts God's commandments. You also find that word used in verse 8, and there it's rendered concupiscence in the King James translation. Paul said, I would not have known sin, especially the sin of coveting, had it not been for the law. And that is, he would not have experienced that desire, apparently, going back to what we talked about earlier. He might have, you know, thought about that and maybe done it, but it would not have been brought to his attention. He makes another point, and this is with the imperfect tense. He says, the law said. Imperfect tense. To me, I think that's another worthwhile point, whether we think about the Old Testament or the New. When we think about God's law saying something, God said it, and does that continue? Yeah. But for a lot of people, they don't necessarily see sin in those terms, do they? Well, I'm not going to steal on this occasion, but over here, the circumstances are a little different, so now is it okay? Yes. Easy sometimes to think for people to rationalize, normally I wouldn't do that, but because things seem to be a little different, now that activity is going to be okay. And what you have here with that tense, that would tell us that that is simply not true. You also, as you start looking down at verse 8, let's read that as well. 7 and 8, I think I missed 7. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? God forbid. Howbeit I had not known sin except through the law, for I had not known coveting except the law said, thou shalt not covet. But sin, finding occasion, wrought in me through the commandment all manner of coveting, for apart from the law, sin is dead. Now, if you were hearing this information, Paul was presenting this in a sermon, or maybe you were reading this information, do you think that you might be thinking, the Old Testament law was a bad law? I mean, if it brings to mind sin, if it can't save me, I need Jesus, do you think you might be thinking that the Old Testament law might not have been the best arrangement? I might have been thinking that. But Paul says the law is what? Number one, the law is... Let's go back to verse 7. He says, is the law sin? Is the law bad or evil? No. He says, God forbid. May that never be. Howbeit, I had not known sin through the law. But the law was holy. It was righteous. It was good. The law was holy in the sense that it was from God. It was righteous, not in the sense that it was going to be able to do what the New Testament does for us, but it was going to allow people to be led to God at the right time. I want to go back and talk about the sinful passions through the law for just a second. That word was, this is a quote from Vine, frequently used to denote a base of operations in war. The command then provided sin with a base of operations and attack upon the soul. And that's what sin does. It is like that base of operations that seeks to attack God's people. Steve?
Well, it occurred to me, whether you know about it or not, if it's wrong, it's wrong. And as kind of the basis of some of the laws we have in this country, you know, ignorance of the law doesn't count, you know. It's because you didn't know that was against the law. It's on the books. So.
Yeah.
So just because you didn't know that this was wrong or you were ignorant until you heard about the law and now you know.
We have people who do a lot of... That's right. We have people who do a lot of interesting things with the law, and sometimes they think that those same interesting things can be done in the spiritual realm. Those two don't always equate, but people sometimes fail to see that. And then you have some other people, they simply think that we can get away with some things in the spiritual realm, once again, or we can get away with some things in the physical realm, therefore we can get away with some things in the spiritual realm. And that is not true. But, yeah, you're exactly right. Anybody else? Gary?
Back, we were talking about when the law was introduced, that some things were eternal laws. They were already wrong before Moses said they were wrong. Is this verse saying that? I mean, obviously, I hear what you're saying, but is he saying that?
Which verse are we talking about?
The coveting, verse 7.
Okay.
Is coveting only, like, did he learn about coveting because it was in the law, or was coveting not sinful until it was put into the law? Because you can't convict someone of being covetous if it's not a law, if there's not a law against it.
Okay, you've got at least two questions there, and maybe a third one implied. going back to that discussion we had a while back in a different class, if, for example, God had not said that murder was wrong, he had not had a law about murder, or if you back it up even a little bit more, if there had never been any creature that was able to be murdered, would murder still be wrong?
I think we came to the conclusion that yes.
Yeah, not everybody in the class came to that conclusion, but that seemed, whether right or wrong, that seemed to be the majority conclusion, that there are some characteristics that flow from God. But let's use a different one. Suppose nobody ever existed that would be capable of determining truth from error. Could falsehood exist?
No one could determine
truth from error. Well, yeah, obviously I have God. But if nobody ever tells a lie, could falsehood exist?
Well, is it that no one can determine truth from falsehood?
No, well, God can.
Sure. But your initial premise was that no one else would be capable of doing so.
Correct.
The fact that we can't determine the one from the other, so falsehood is merely speaking something that isn't true.
Correct.
And if we can't determine what's true from what isn't, then absolutely falsehood could exist. Now, would it be imputed to us as sin? If we're incapable of determining truth from falsehood, that's potentially a different question. But certainly falsehood, the speaking of something untrue could happen.
Yeah. The opposite of God is obviously the opposite of good and right. I mean, God is holy and truthful and righteous and just and so forth. So the opposite of God, I would argue that yes, that would exist. And if that proposition can be sustained, then I think you can extend that out and say if you're talking about murder, even if there were never a murder, all those things would still be, we would be able to classify those items as morally wrong. Now, that was kind of the question that you didn't ask, but it was sort of implied. Now, going back to what you're talking about as far as the coveting. Exactly, I mean, we don't know enough about Paul's life to determine, number one, what he was tempted to covet. Like I mentioned earlier, it could have been three or four or maybe a dozen different things. Might he have coveted to some degree one or more of those things had he never known about coveting? I think just knowing the nature of people, that's probably a pretty good possibility. But at the same time, did that desire get amped up when he became aware of the law? I mean, it would be like, listen, you're going to a Bible class, or you're going to a sermon, and let's just use the Masonic Lodge, for example. That's not something that a lot of people preach on right now, or use witch doctors, whichever one you want to take. And you are involved with witch doctors, you're a witch doctor, or you're involved with the Masonic Lodge, and you go and you hear a presentation on being a witch doctor or the Masonic Lodge, that's a little closer to home, and you hear someone lay out the case for both of those things being wrong. Well, now, you might have wondered a little bit. I mean, you're a Christian and you're a witch doctor. You might have been thinking, well, you know, I'm trying to kind of pull from two powers here. And that seems a little odd, but you've never really thought that through. Or the Masonic Lodge, I think that's a little closer to home. When you look at some of their teachings, you find some people who would say, I never knew. I was at one of the lower levels, and I never knew what some of the other level, some of the other levels involve. And maybe they, before they get to that point, somebody lays it out in a lesson. If you hear one of those two lessons, or both, what's going to be your response? Okay. Well, I think one of the things that a person might say is, I've got a lot to think about now. Yeah. I mean, I'd never heard about, you know, the fact that God hates witch doctors. Not hate in the sense that I don't want them to be saved, but that's an activity that is abhorrent to me. And I never heard, or I never picked up from Scripture, that being a member of this organization could be contrary to God's will. So you kind of step back from that and think, oh boy, what am I involved with? And my sense of Romans chapter 7 is that's kind of Paul's take. Maybe he had a little insight as far as coveting, but one day, maybe in the Jewish synagogue, maybe in the younger years, maybe as the older years came by, maybe there was somebody who got up and one day and said, thou shalt not covet. This is what it means. And perhaps the illustration that was given in that synagogue was exactly the thing that Paul had been thinking about or doing or coveting. And bang, he got whacked on the head that day. And he said, maybe even remembering back to that day, and said, it connected for me that day. I was guilty. You have people today sometimes saying, preacher sure stepped on my toes today. Well, what are they saying? might have known about that a little bit before, but today that really registered, that really connected. So that's kind of where I would go with the three questions that you asked, or two and a half. Anybody else? Stan?
The law was given to a limited number of people. The law was meant to prepare us for the coming of Christ. The law, when Christ came, then the apostles and the Christians, the new Christians, started to teach it, whatever. Then they went out into the world to teach the Gentiles, etc., etc. How were the Jews, in actuality, better prepared for it than the world was? As far as I know, the Bible doesn't say it was much harder to teach the Gentiles than it was the Jews.
Yeah. I don't think they were that well prepared for it. In fact, when you back up a little bit in Romans chapter 2, Paul says you thought you were a light to the people who were spiritually blind, but you really weren't. And that wasn't God's fault, but that was a failure. When I think about the Jews and how they looked at God's law, Matthew 5, for example, comes to mind. Jesus said, you've heard that it was said. He didn't say you've heard that it was written, but he said you've heard that it was said. So there are apparently some of that maybe oral teaching that we were talking about with Gary just a moment ago. They heard, but they kind of heard what they wanted to hear. For example, you think about what Jesus says, Matthew 5, 27, 28. He talks about looking at a woman to lust after her. You think about some of the religious leaders. Well, I didn't touch her. And that's kind of what people today will do. I didn't touch her. Maybe I leered at her, and maybe I made some suggestive comments toward her. I did everything but touch her. So legally, I'm good. You know, you can't get me for leering. You can't get me for being tempted. You can't get me, well, maybe not too much as far as saying terrible things to her. But Jesus says, look, you guys have missed the point. And the same thing was true with anger. I didn't kill him. I didn't hit him. I just hated him to death. Well, Jesus says you missed the point of the law. The law really contained those principles. But since you didn't get it, I'm here. We're going to have a New Testament. And we're going to try to make a lot of those things a whole lot clearer. So we're focusing on the heart, because you folks really just concentrated on the outward act.
So did that make all those years under the law a moot point?
I wouldn't go quite that far. God accomplished what he needed to accomplish with the law. The law was supposed to be like a giant chain to help the people feel the weight of sin, and it did that. They did realize their sinfulness, probably not to the degree that they should have, but still, it was enough. Then you throw in the captivities there, and it was enough to say, we need help. But even when that happened, Jesus comes along, and what do the people do? Well, they don't really respond to him all that favorably, at least for a while. So you have God talking about how rebellious they were throughout the Old Testament, and they were some thick-headed people. But as we look at them, we have to ask, sometimes, are we any better today? And sometimes we have to sit back and say, man is a very stubborn and rebellious creature, because we are.
So we talk about the law, we go to Galatians chapter 3 and see that the intent of the law was that it should be like a schoolmaster, like a guardian for us. And by us, I mean really humanity as such, at a time when we needed that kind of guidance. If we look at the entire structure of the Bible beginning to end, the way it was placed into canon, what we see is we have this series of small narratives, different characters, different events that occur throughout it. But then there's the meta narrative. There's the story that begins Genesis 1 and concludes at the end of John's Revelation, that is the story of God relating to all of humanity. And so we go through these periods of time. Humanity initially was just two people in the garden, perfect in their innocence, able to walk in God's presence, which is what he intended our natural state to be. We're now trapped outside of that because sin's come into the world. This is not our natural state. But we ruined that. So we had everything given to us. We ruined it. So then God said, all right. Sort of the head of the household now. You're going to be the one to relate to me on behalf of your family. Well, that didn't